Hi there, and welcome to the Living with SMA podcast. We're here to have conversations about living with spinal muscular atrophy. Throughout this podcast, we will be covering lots of different topics, from preparing for university, getting the most from your personal budget, sex and relationships, and lots more. So we invite different hosts from across the SMA community to come together here. We want to answer your questions, provide you with useful tips and recommendations, and also share personal stories. So please do reach out and connect with us here at the charity SMA UK. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find the podcast useful. Right, so our first conversation in today's episode is with Portia Thorman. Have I pronounced that right, Portia?
Yeah.
Good. And obviously all around nusinersen, or Spinraza as it's sometimes known as well. So it'd be great to kick off with learn a bit about you, Portia, and your connection to SMA and just the backstory would be really lovely.
Yeah, no problem. So I was working as a primary school teacher. I had two teenage girls, and then we had sort of a 10-year gap while we sort of sorted out our careers, me and my husband. And then we had Martha, and it all was great. And we wanted to have another child to be Martha's buddy. And obviously we found out you were having a boy, which was really exciting after three girls, so that was great. There was no history in our family of any problems at all. No, pregnancy was absolutely fine. We were all very excited. Birth was normal, had him in a pool. It was all great. And then when he got to 5 weeks old, he got a cold. And he just obviously wasn't coping very well. And he was, you know, really struggling to breathe. So we took him into A&E. They admitted him. And he was probably at the local for about a week or so. And then we were blue lighted up to London, up to St Thomas's, where he was in intensive care. And, it was a cold that he wasn't coping with. So he was intubated, ventilated, probably for a couple of weeks. We actually had our first Christmas in hospital with him, still completely unaware there was anything wrong with him. Failed extubation, and he was a big baby. You know, it was quite surprising that he was struggling with this cold because he was a big, chubby, seemingly healthy baby. And then he failed extubation. That was really, really depressing. Spent our first Christmas there away from our girls. They were with my husband's family for Christmas, and we were together with Ezra. Finally got home for the new year, and I noticed, in fact, one of the nurses noticed while we were in intensive care in London that his tone wasn't very good, that he didn't seem to be moving very much. And she did mention it to one of the doctors, and he was like, okay, well, we won't worry about that now, because they angel wing them when they're babies in hospital, so they wrap up their arms so they can't pull the tube out. So they thought that because he'd been chewed for so long, he'd got weak because of that. Mm. But then I noticed that he couldn't hold his head up. He couldn't even lift a dummy to his mouth. I remember putting him on a changing table and his legs just flopped over the side. And I'd take him to health visitors and they'd say, oh, it's because he's been poorly. He needs to get his strength up. So I thought, swimming. I'll take him swimming. That'll be great for him. He'll be able to move in the water. Took him swimming and there was nothing. His legs didn't move at all. And I was like, began to panic a little bit. I was like, is not right. So took him back. I think I saw three, maybe four separate health visitors. And by this point, he couldn't even grasp my finger. He'd lost pretty much everything. I think all he could do was move his arm here. That was about it. And couldn't roll, couldn't move his head. So I took him in and I was really upset. I cried and I said, just look at him. This isn't because he's been poorly. He can't even move anything. And they were more concerned, which I hadn't even noticed, actually, that he was breathing with his belly. Mm-hmm. I took him to a mother and toddlers group, and I lay him next to another baby on the mat. And the mum said to me, why is he breathing like that? And I hadn't actually noticed it until I compared it with another baby. And I was like, oh, that is a very good point. Why is he breathing like that? I have no idea. So finally, this health visitor, when I went in and had a paddy and cried, they're like, okay, we're going to refer him up to Rainbow Ward. You need to take him up now. So I took him to our local children's ward. They looked at him. By this point, he was quite tired and upset. And one of the consultants said to me, what's your greatest fear? I was like, that he'll be in a wheelchair? And she was like, well, I can't, you know, promise that that won't happen. But they didn't really say what they thought it might be or anything.
Yeah.
They were trying to look at his tongue, but he was crying, so they couldn't get a good look at his tongue. But they didn't tell me why they were trying to look at his tongue. But now I know it's because in SMA type 1, the tongue wobbles constantly.
And type 2, yeah, mine does as well. Yeah.
But, you know. But they didn't tell me anything else. And then they were going to do MRIs, but they didn't know. And then they just sent me home. And then I got a phone call the next day from the hospital in London. Now, we live in Ramsgate, Kent, so it's a good 2 hours from London. Mm-hmm. And they rang me at about 8 a.m. and they said, we'd like you here for 10 o'clock. Bearing in mind I have 3 other children going to school. Yeah. Quite a little baby. So Ezra by this stage is now 4 months old, mm-hmm. I think. So he's been quite a long time from that first stay in London hospital to now. It hadn't been recognised and he'd lost quite a lot of movement already. So I sorted out the kids. I drove up to London. I didn't want to go into central London, so I left my car at Greenwich. Got the tube with Ezra and his buggy into central London. And then we were told that they thought that he had spinal muscular atrophy, which I'd never heard of ever, and that it was a very early diagnosis and it wasn't a good prognosis. Again, they didn't tell me very much. They just said we had to do a blood test. And they would like me to stay in the hospital for a couple of weeks. So I was like, my car's in Greenwich. I can't stay here. I've got a family at home. So then they paid for a taxi for me back to my car and I went home. But then you start Googling. And we're talking at a point before Spinraza was available in the UK. There was nothing on the internet about treatment at that point. This is 4 years ago now. So it was very doom and gloom. I can really remember reading how you have to take a suction machine out with you, and that just filled me with dread. I was like, oh, that sounds like the most awful thing I've ever heard. And you know, they have to lie on their side and they could choke at any moment. And oh, it was an awful reading. And then I read about the tongue thing. And then of course I looked at him and I saw it is. And so it was a very awful 2 week wait without really much support from anyone.
Yeah.
And then we were pulled back in for the meeting where we were told, actually, they didn't actually say he's got SMA. They just started into like, you need to just enjoy the time you've got with him. And I was like, hold on. So he's got it. So he has. And they're like, yeah, he has got it. But that was when we found out about Spinraza. And Ezra's neurologist said, there is a treatment that's just finished trials in America. It was very successful. You know, we can't promise anything. Some kids are walking if they get this treatment early enough. But of course, listening to this, my brain is in like this massive fog because I've basically just been told my child is probably not going to live till he's two. So I really wasn't in a place to be absorbing any kind of information. They were trying to teach us respiratory physio in this appointment as well. And my husband did it because I was just in bits. So she said she'd written letters to the drugs company that produced Spinraza. And we might be, and she said, you're the first family I've been able to say this to. So the timing of it is really amazing because I'd have three children, bearing in mind for each one of them it was a 1 in 4 chance that they could have had SMA. So any of my children before, if it had been them, they wouldn't have made it. But then we're like, it's a trial drug, we don't know. So do we say yes, do we say no? So we didn't really know anything and we weren't really prepared for what life would be like because I was thinking, brilliant, there's a drug, he's going to be okay, I'll be able to, you know, he'll be able to walk and it's all going to be fine. But then from that appointment, we were then quite quickly back in intensive care afterwards, which kind of made me realise if I don't say yes to this drug, we're going to lose him. Because he was very, it was a very early diagnosis. So he's, especially respiratory wise, seemed very weak. As soon as he got a sniffle, he couldn't cope with it. And with three other kids at home, they're really in cold home all the time. So we said yes, not really knowing what that meant for our family. Like no one said to me, you're going to have to give up your job to look after him. You're going to have to, you know, your career is now, that is it. No one said you're going to have to bring home a ventilator, a suction machine, a cough assist. And I think maybe that was because they didn't know how the drug would work on him. They didn't know if it would be necessary or not. Looking back, would I have said yes to the drug if I knew how it was going to change our lives? I don't know. I don't know. Yes, no, I know, because he's such a remarkable, amazing human being. But I think it was kind of good for me to kind of get this information sort of as I went along, because I think it probably would be too much if
it was... We were saying about that before, weren't we, when we sort of just, you know, getting to meet each other before we hit record, and then sort of me in my late 30s with type 2, and you've seen some people like me with our adult lives with SMA, and it's interesting to know what the future might look like, because of course everyone's story and experience is going to be different as well. But yeah, we sort of said then, didn't we, there's also that just dealing with the now and what's happening now. As you say, there's just hearing that story, I mean, so many things happen for you as a family. It's such a roller coaster, really, of all the different, in you know, events and the information you were trying to digest, and the unknowns. I mean, I'd imagine the unknowns must have been a big stressor, right? Just when you know something, you can plan for it, but when it's a bit just blank and not sure, it must be very hard of how to proceed with that. That's it.
But to be able to see you and people like you, you know, who are married and have kids, and it's just so wonderful. And they do kind of say that Spinraza turns a type 1 into a type 2 almost, which is great. Yeah, so we had a big family meeting about whether we would have Spinraza or not, including all my kids, so they could ask questions. And my middle girl, who was probably about, what was she, 13 probably at the time, she was concerned that she didn't want to get to know Ezra and love him and then lose him when he was older. She would kind of would rather have said goodbye then. Oh gosh. But they can't answer questions like that, because they didn't know at that point, because it was only these kids in America that were on the trial that they had to compare to. So really all our questions were sort of answered, we don't really know. We hope so. There was one little boy in America who was on YouTube, and his mom had done some YouTube videos. And I really remember there was a video of him sitting up in a chair. And I was like, oh, if he could just sit up, that, I mean, just that alone would improve his quality of life so much, just being able to sit up. So those YouTube videos really gave us loads of hope, that little boy.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because you mentioned sort of when you Googled stuff, and like separate to SMA and, you know, treatments, I think there's generally that thing of, if we ever have something going on health-wise, and sometimes the worst thing you can do is Google it. Like, you're going to get the worst case scenarios. But at the same time, it's a very powerful resource to learn about different things. But just interesting there, you said about the actual kind of YouTube, the sort of social media side of it as well. So what kind of information did you get through the sort of videos and maybe Google as well, but social media, about what other children, maybe in other countries, had experienced with the drug?
It was only this one little boy that had been on the trial in America, and his family were really pleased with the results. Oh, and there was another, my auntie lives in Canada, and she was a nurse, in fact, a pediatric nurse in Canada, and she knew of this drug and of some parents that had tried it with their children. But I think, kind of like me, they're expecting it to be some kind of miracle cure, and they're expecting them to, you know, start following the normal developmental things. And when they realized they basically had to turn their home into a hospital, you know, with all this equipment, and they decided not to go ahead, not to keep on with it.
Right.
Okay. Because they didn't think that it was much of a quality of life for their baby, which I can understand that. And my family, like my mom and my sister, they were, after listening to my auntie, were quite, they didn't want me to feel bad about saying no, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They're thinking about me and my life and how would it affect me.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's the kind of choice only a mother can make, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And as we said before, everyone, you know, I'm imagining sort of various people listening to the podcast, and, you know, the other parents with type 1 babies, both before Spinraza and after, that there's just so many variables that in the end it's that individual personal choice. And I can imagine your mom and your sister, it was for you not to feel forced or boxed into anything, that you could make that right decision for you and for the family and for Ezra as well. But
and
so in terms of looking at the process, so you're aware of this treatment called nusinersen or Spinraza, and saw some videos of people in other countries, or one or two videos maybe. What then played out in terms of actually kind of, you know, getting the treatment?
The neurologist wrote letters because she'd heard that Biogen were doing an open access program for Spinraza. So to get it into the UK, they would choose some kids who they thought would benefit from it the most, basically. Mm-hmm. So it had to be in this specific age range, which Ezra did fit the bill. So they said that we qualified for the open access program. And on the admission into PICU after the diagnosis, they gave him his first dose. And I think the Biogen had said that you can't be intubated, like that was one of the provisos for getting it. Mm-hmm. But because he was intubated because of a virus, because he had a cold, not because of purely because of his SMA, he managed to get around that.
Mm-hmm. So there's quite a few criteria that
I mean, there's way more now. I don't think he would have got it now.
Right.
Thinking back, I don't think because he was so poorly, I don't think he probably wouldn't have qualified for it.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting to think that it was lucky that it wasn't licensed for us.
Yeah.
So well now, he just needed to, you needed a while to build up that strength, I think. So from that first dose, we had 8 PICU admissions in his first 2 years. So every time he got a cold, we were still going in there.
Yeah.
As far as his motor movement went, you know, we were noticing big things. I mean, big breaths. It's like every tiny little thing becomes like
I can relate to that. Yeah.
I remember lying on the bathroom floor and he put his arm up in the air. And I was like,
whoa.
Everything just becomes so exciting. Every little step fills you with so much joy. I remember his first Christmas, because he had no head control. And his first Christmas, he was sat at the table with us eating lunch for dinner. And he very slowly was like, oh, and we were like, come on, Ezra, you can do it. And he got his head up and everyone cheered, and it's just so lovely. And then the next year, so when he was 2, he sat up by himself for the first time, which was really the goal that I had put all my hopes on, was that he could sit up. Because if you can't sit up, your quality of life is just, in my mind anyway, reduced. And I've always said to myself, I would never just keep Ezra alive. If he was in a position where I was just keeping him alive, it's not fair. I want him to live. I want him to have a life, not just be kept. And that's always been my benchmark. and I really struggle with this. Like, we're Christians. So faith-wise, I found this really difficult because when we got his diagnosis, we prayed and prayed and screamed and prayed. And but I found comfort in the fact that God says, just don't worry. Don't worry, just believe. And I've just carried that with me through the whole time. And that fear of, you know, when I take him out, he might choke, or, you know, he might be sick and aspirate, and all those fears you have taking him out so that he has a life and not just keeping him in by his, like, machinery. Being able to let go of that has really, really helped me. And just to just go for it, just do it. You know, I've got him a power chair now, and he loves life. He's great. But I did have to really let go of that fear, because I can see how it would be so easy just to keep him in because he's sick.
Yeah, so cool.
And there's no, but I do refuse to do that. Sometimes to my detriment, to be honest.
And as always in life, it's all the balance, isn't it? So it's sort of those two. And I do, what you were just saying, I mean, you know, when I was going through my diagnosis, I was at 18 months. I don't remember it, but I know chatting to my mum and dad later on, that obviously they were the ones that were more, you know, experiencing it more than I was. Yeah. But apparently my granddad said to my mum, you know, you're always given as much as you can cope with as people. And that, I know that you know, my grandparents that side were very religious, and there was definitely a sort of faith aspect to that, you know, we could always cope with however much life gives us. And I know that gave my mum a lot of strength as well.
Yeah, definitely. So that has been an interesting side of it for us. But,
yeah,
I mean, he's super now.
Yeah, I'm fortunate enough to meet him earlier, and he's you can see he's got that zest for life, that SMA zest for life. So
yeah.
Cool. So, I mean, obviously, I guess my last question was around sort of any potential impact and effect of the treatment. You sort of did mention a couple of things, like a bit more physical movement as a result, and he's now able to sit up with the power jet, so he probably did cover it off in many ways. But yeah, any sort of other thoughts in terms of, you know, where you're at now, or maybe a bit of a look to the future as well?
Yeah, I think, well, we now, so he's 4.5, he'll be 5 in November. He's been going to mainstream nursery, which I thought might be a struggle getting him into a mainstream school, because he's incredibly bright. And I didn't want him to go, the special needs school here is really for kids with learning difficulties, not for kids with, there don't seem to be any schools for kids with physical disabilities. Yeah. So I tried a couple of local nurseries who had a meeting with me, and they were like, I don't know, I'm not sure that we're set up for it. Sort of the physical surroundings, the building. And then I went to the school literally around the corner from me. I sent him an email, and I sent the head a long email, like a page of what his diagnosis means, and really, really deep. And he sent me an email back, and it was one line. He said, we're here to serve our community. And I was just like, oh, that is amazing. So I went in, and they've been brilliant. So part of his diagnosis is that he has a nurse overnight. Because he's on his ventilator, he has a SATS machine, so he just has someone sitting up with him. I found that quite hard to accept, actually, because I was very determined that I could look after him at home. So we're sent home with all this equipment, and they said to me when I left PICU after his diagnosis, and when he'd been put on his ventilator, they said, do you want to wait for a care package? I thought they meant like a box of nappies or like a package. I don't know what a care package is. I never heard them. So I was like, no, it's fine. I'll go home with a care package. So, I did it all
by myself.
I didn't know what that meant. And they do use a lot of words that I just like pretended I knew what they were talking about.
Yeah.
Actually, I have a clue.
Yeah, so, I mean, it opens up, because core focus today is obviously around nurse and nursing and spin bars. And I think, you know, definitely with the type one babies, it's been a big game changer in terms of that, you know, literally the sort of health and, you know, very much just the health side. But fortunately, as you're saying, now things are going a good way because of, or helped by Spinraza. It then opens up that broader SMA conversations of chairs and funding chairs and care and funding care and going to nursery and school and the sort of the physical environment and the attitudes of the world. And it sort of it opens up that part of yours and Ezra's and the family's journey. Yeah. And there's there's all those different narratives, if you like, that are very lots of bits to explore within all of those as well.
Yeah. Sure. All these things that Spinraza have made possible. I mean, I never knew if I would be able to be potty trained because I'm presuming it's a muscle thing and I just didn't know. But we've been trying since he was two and he's out of nappies now, ready for reception. So
yeah, brilliant.
Like, all these things that Spinraza have made possible that people didn't even know before. Yeah. So it's kind of like he's a bit of a trailblazer, which is lovely.
Yeah. That's amazing to see. It's amazing.
Yeah, really cool. So yeah, he's at nursery. He is an absolute whiz at driving a power chair. You've never seen anything like it. He can shut drawers with the back of it, and
amazing that you pick up that spatial awareness so quickly, isn't it?
Oh, amazing! So he started with a whizzy bug when he was three, which is quite slowly because they're small. was a whiz at that, and now we've graduated onto what's called a tiny tracks, which is like. Goes about 4 miles an hour, which I think is the same as adult power chair.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
Indeed. Really, I have to run to keep up with him.
Yeah.
So then things like road safety and all these things that normal four-year-olds would have to do, he's been able to do.
I can remember like me and my sister, who's not quite some either, having like kid fights, and it was this weird. If I used my chair, I could really hurt her, but I didn't want to really hurt her. But I couldn't punch her enough to like do a kind of little play fight, you know. It was just a weird dynamic of like how to use the chair but not use the chair, you know.
Nothing. Ezra, if he gets cross, he will ram his teacher. So he just like
they need to behave. Those teachers.
teaching them the teachers have to tell them off like any other child as well, because I think people are inclined to be a bit, you know, softer with him. But he is just a really, thanks to Spinraza, really normal, intelligent, clever, happy, mobile little boy. And it's been wonderful.
That's great to hear.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Portia, I really appreciate your time and sharing the story and sort of those earlier days. I can imagine how difficult they were for you and the family, so I really appreciate your honesty and openness and obviously you know where we all are at the SMA UK as all these new adventures come along. I'm sure you're already aware there's going to be those other types of challenges, but the good thing is that lots of others have been there and done that to help as well.
So. It's a brilliant community. It's pretty
All right, thanks a lot, and I'll see you soon. So we're continuing our conversation with Lucy Nursing today with Mark and Pana, or the Wilsons, as I may refer to you. I love the fact you got that down in your title there. Really very much similar to our conversation previously with Portia. It'd be great to hear your background story when SMA came into your lives, and just however much you care to share would be really interesting to kick off with.
Okay.
Thank you, Martin. So we got pregnant, we lived in Shanghai in China, and that's when we got pregnant with Adi, our son who has type 2 SMA. And it wasn't until he was about a year old, I think, that we started to notice something wasn't right. He was cruising and doing all the things that most babies his age would be doing. And it was leading up to Christmas. We brought him to the UK because we'd come and see family for Christmas. And again, noticed his crawling pattern had changed. He wasn't standing up as much. So that's when the whole process of trying to check out what was wrong with him had started. Started it off in Shanghai and carried it on over here in England. They said it would take quite a few months to figure out what was wrong with him. So we just went back to China because we had private healthcare over there and got things sorted. And unfortunately, you know, we got the news that you don't really want to hear, where they have something wrong with them. And it was it was a real big shock. And it was March 2017 that we found out that he had SMA type 2. And yeah, I guess everybody feels differently. It was hard to deal with for me personally, and I'm sure for you as well, Mark. Mm-hmm. But we just had to kind of grieve, get it over and done with, and get things rolling for him. So myself and my son returned to England in May 2017 while Mark closed everything up over there. And then, started everything else off in England for him. So all his care, his treatment, etc. Mm. I don't know if you want to add anything else to that.
No, that's kind of the story of Adi's diagnosis, I guess. I suppose as we transitioned back to England, we began to look for support, and we began to investigate the condition, learn as much as we could about it. And of course, we're still learning now how it affects Adi and so on. But for us, we wanted to get in contact with parents like us in experiencing things like we were experiencing. And I think pretty soon after Panna returned, so the summer of 2017, that's when we heard about SMA UK or SMA Support UK, I think it was at the time. And so that was a really big step for us to realise that we weren't alone in that sense, and there was support there for us. And
even a community, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Just like Adi.
Even though it felt like you were the only ones experiencing it, you realised there was a lot of support there for you. So, from 2016 through to 2017, that was kind of our experience, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thanks for sharing that. Again, sort of similar to what I was saying with Portia, but obviously everyone's story is different in terms of, like, you know, you were living and obviously working as well in China at the time. And so those parts of everyone's story is different. And then there's the sort of type 1, type 2, type 3 differences as well, like Portia's son Ezra's type 1. And so there was definitely, as we all understand the condition more and more, a lot more of that healthcare side, you know, particularly with the type 1 baby. I mean, so for the last few years on the health side, have there been any higher complications around sort of colds and coughs and breathing, that type of thing, or has that not been so bad?
It was bad, actually. I think through the winter of 2017 through all of 2018, Adi was hospitalized multiple times. It could have almost been double figures with a variety of colds.
He had
a coronavirus at one point. We got to know the names, the technical names of different kinds of colds, of rhinoviruses. And he was really ill. He was really ill numerous times. He's been in intensive care. He's been on his chest has collapsed, his lungs collapsed. And that was a really tough time, because I think it was unrelenting more than anything. And he was hospitalized every 6 to 8 weeks, and he'd be in for 10-14 days at a time. And so we as a family, that was extremely tough. And thank goodness he has become stronger. And he's
in the last year, I think.
Yeah.
He has had coughs and colds, but he's able to overcome them at home, and we've not had to use sort of the nebulizers or the suction unit like we have had in the past. And I don't know whether that's due to lockdown, he's not in touch with a lot more people, or is it because of nursing? We're hoping it is nursing, because he is at school, he's surrounded by kids with cold. His sister comes home from nursery with a cold, and she has horrible chesty coughs, and he's touch wood. He's dealing with it pretty well, so we're hoping that at least his respiratory function is improving, but or whether he's got older and his immunity is built up. But that year and a half of just being in and out of hospital and not, you know, working with a respiratory team who don't know about his condition. So by the sixth or seventh time that he's been admitted, we're saying, no, you need to do this or you need to do that, because you're becoming an expert in his condition. They're the expert in looking after his respiratory function. So working together with the multidisciplinary team, they were very good, because they always told us what was happening. They got our opinion on things and made sure that we were happy with what was going on with him. But it was really, really tough, because you're working. And I remember working at his bedside because he was a teacher, so you had to go into work. I could work from wherever, so I was sat in the hospital while he's sleeping, working away. And it was mental thinking about it now, how we got through it. But you just do, don't you?
You do. Yeah. I mean, I remember, like you say, planning lessons at his bedside while he's on his vent. And every now and again, you think, this isn't really normal, is it?
But it's our normal,
but as Pana says, it's our normal. And he is very tough, and we realise we are as well. We got through it, continued to get through it. And he has had a really good run of health. And of course, you know, the world's a little bit different now, isn't it, with the kind of viruses that may or may not affect him greatly. And that's another thing that we're looking at next, is how to protect him as best we can. He's begun school. He's just finished foundation. He's really excited to start year one and is as normal a 5.5-year-old as you can find, really. We forget that a lot of his and our normal isn't normal, whatever that means. But we just keep adapting like he does. So I think Pana would feel the same. We've learned a lot from him as well, and a lot through the experience of living with SMA. Another acronym. Living with SMA, and I'm sure, given the opportunity, he'd be explaining all this to you himself. we'll do it.
He makes you resilient, because he just gets on with everything and anything, like getting onto a ventilator. They told us to sort of trial it at first, and then he had to be admitted while we were trialing it. He had to be admitted into hospital. They said, well, do you just want to trial it now here? And we did, and he just got on with it. And he's always been that way, and he's always positive about stuff, and he always makes us kind of feel happy about things and good about things. And no child should have to make the parents feel happy, because sometimes you do get frustrated and you try not to do it in front of him, obviously, and we don't, but there are times when you're frustrated about so many different things, and then he'll help you out, and he'll just make you smile by telling you a silly joke or something. And he's a really good boy, and it just shows you that he's not, we don't want his disability to stop him or SMA to stop him. And we keep reiterating that to him, and he seems to just go ahead and do what he wants, which is great.
Brilliant. As interesting you say, you know, whether some of the improvements are correlated to nusinersen or not, and we'll kind of put a pin in that. We'll come back to that, in terms of even other observations that you may or may not have had since having the treatment. Just in terms of that, the lead up to being aware of any treatment, I think you sort of said as every parent, it's interesting as well that in doing the interviews the last couple of days, we randomly found this old album, and there was photos of me when I was like 4 or 5, stood up in calipers, and so just like through having these conversations, it's quite coincidental that then there was these photos we're looking at last night of me at that age as well. But I can empathize and imagine, and know speaking to my parents, that there was a lot of information to take. There was a lot of emotion around kind of not having the sort of situation that you would have been planning to as parents, and those frustrations you were just talking to there, Pana. So just kind of moving it into the treatment stuff. I mean, when you first found out, were any treatments on the horizon, and when did you start to actually, speak to consultants about getting the nusinersen?
I mean, we had to actually look back over emails and social media posts to remind ourselves of the story, because life moves on pretty quickly. And it was interesting looking back at them. If memory serves me correctly, after Pana and Adi and then later myself moved back home through the summer of 2017, getting in touch with SMA UK and other families, I think we became aware of the treatments that were available in other countries sort of through the autumn time 2017.
I remember reading something when we were in China, actually. It was 2016 that the results had come out for Spinraza, because I remember sat in our living room in Shanghai reading about nusinersen and that, but obviously we didn't have it in the UK, so we felt a bit hopeful. Like you said, we found out more when we got in touch with SMA and started to read more stuff, that there was stuff in the pipeline or had been trialed.
I think when we, again, it's interesting to recall it, isn't it? And think about, you know, a few years ago, because it is, it's, you know, 4 odd years ago now. I do remember as wondering how we might be able to access it in the UK when we did come home, and then slowly becoming aware of primary. I mean, you've obviously worked in the NHS for a long time, but certainly myself on the idea of commissioning services within the NHS, sort of like quite technical discussions around what medicines are accessible, which aren't, who makes a decision. I'd not heard of NICE before, for instance, or if I had, I didn't know how it worked, and the arguments back and forth then. And I think I do remember on seeing different posts of social media of children having access to something, and I remember a lad on a YouTube video, you know, having typed to and sitting up and doing things that Adi, you know, we were worried that Adi would never be able to do, and that was a few treatments in for him. I couldn't say where he was from, but I do remember seeing
States, I think,
seeing something. So it became, I guess, apparent to us that it wasn't going to be straightforward. It wasn't going to be a case of going to a GP, getting something easily. And we had a good couple of years ahead of us of campaigning, I think.
So it's in terms of, you know, getting that access, would you define it, a lot of the energy around the campaigning you just mentioned, or sort of once there was that you know, official access allowed, was there also various hoops you had to go through in terms of just then getting the okay as well?
I mean, I remember as we had our MP was really helpful. So I remember writing lots of letters and having dialogue with him. I remember going to an MP surgery as part of the campaign.
Was brilliant. He put the questions to the Prime Minister as well. Well, question time. Prime Minister's questions. Everything that we'd said to him. And I think it was that going to that surgery and speaking to him face to face and him seeing the family together, united, it, I think it really hit him. And they were absolutely fantastic. And then then it was a case of, would you like to be interviewed on BBC Radio? Leicester, yes, okay. Would you like to be interviewed by BBC East Midlands News? Yes, okay. So, because it was after NICE rejected the first... application when they first said no, and then the campaign sort of escalated even more because people were so frustrated and annoyed. And like Mark said, I've worked for the NHS and I work in research, so I've heard of NICE, but that's when I was coming face to face with something and something that's more passionate to me, and kind of thinking, well, I don't understand why you hold the light, hold in your hands the key to unlock so many futures for these children by giving them something that could potentially improve their lives exponentially. And that became frustrating, but I remember there was just different things going on. You were interviewed on radio so many times, we were then interviewed by the news, and then just waiting, basically, because then it had to be resubmitted, and the waiting, the constant waiting. But we also had somebody else,
a public health campaigner
who we can't remember his name, bless him. But he did a lot as well for us, campaigning for Spinraza or nursing. It was just, but then actually, I don't know what, if you remember as well, but once it was then approved, it was a case of, right, is Leicester now set up for it? Because we're in Leicester. And we were always sort of, it was in parallel to make sure once it gets approved, are you guys ready? And then that was a hurdle for us because nobody here, the neuromuscular consultant was leaving, they didn't have the right person to take the post, and it was person taking over it temporarily, and they just didn't have the infrastructure, it wasn't set up. So they recommended referring Adi over to Sheffield. And then that started where they had to see him, and then it was just the journey's over. So we felt maybe it was a blessing in disguise that he's gone to the right place, and it's only an hour and 15 minutes up the road. We make sort of a night of it and stay over on a Monday night, and then he has it on a Tuesday, and then we come home because it's too much traveling all of that way. Then you get a lumbar puncture, then having to travel all the way back. So it just became a really nice family little vacation for one night.
Loving Sheffield now.
It's weird.
But that's frustrating because now we have so many appointments with them, which, bless them, they try to make sure they do it all in sort of 1 month or one appointment, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of traveling for us to do every 6 months plus every 4 months with the injection, but it's working and we're happy that he's getting it, basically. So yeah it's good.
And what does Ardy say about it, like in terms of the trips and the hospital, but also the procedure? What's his sort of feedback to you on it?
I mean, like Pana said earlier, he's a very resilient little boy. And the first time I think he was so unaware of everything, it was an exciting trip and, you know, oh, wow, okay, this all happens. And the second and third time, I think he knew what was coming. So he got himself a little bit nervous and he got himself quite hot and bothered. And I remember that.
I think like anxiety.
Yeah. The funny thing, it wasn't funny, but they were saying, I'm not sure if we can do this. You think he's got a cold. We might need to send you home and not have it today and come back next week. We're like, nah, no, he's not got a cold. He's just really, he effectively wound himself up, giving himself a temperature almost.
Yeah.
And he was
just that anxiety. It's not like an anxiety attack, I guess, because he just breathes faster, therefore your heart rate's going faster. So his blood pressure goes up, his temperature's going up because he's getting all hot and bothered. We're like, no, seriously, this is just him panicking. Can you please just call the consultant?
So luckily, they, the second, third, fourth, or whatever, there was a little bit of drama, but, you know, we managed to get him seen and get the injection completed. And also early on, there were not hiccups, but they were trying to work out the spacing of the anesthesia. So they were just trying to work out how much, when, what combination worked. And now they've got it down really well. And he, in a weird sort of way, he kind of makes himself fall asleep. So
he gets he kind of meditates.
Yeah,
he meditates. Calm himself down. So
he'll have his first injection, and that shouldn't really make us like a prep, as you know, people no doubt know. And for him, he just lies back and says, "I'm just going to sleep now." And sometimes he's asleep when they come for his second.
Really?
And he's it's amazing like that. And he's it's now we, as Pana says, we've got it down into quite a good routine. You know, we've got the Premier Inn to look forward to every time we go up, and so on. So yeah, now that we're in the flow and the routine of it, and it all manages as well. We've got another one to take with us now. When we first started with Spinraza, we only had Adi. Now we have another great child to think of and, you know, look after. And she sees it as a bit of an adventure now as well. She's just 2. So it is kind of like a family outing in a weird sort of way.
I was thinking of the different people listening to this podcast. And as we sort of always say, everyone's going to have the different narratives, different experiences. But I think that's quite a nice takeaway, almost a tip, if you like, for some people there to sort of turn that into a bit of a adventure and make take the positives of it and all that kind of stuff. Because I can imagine otherwise it is just a very heavy sort of stressful situation. But to have that attitude and that end up making it into a really fun family trip as well, it makes it easier for everybody as well, right?
I think it does. And I think that is probably indicative of how we look at living with SMA and ID and everything, is that there are so many more positives. And of course things are difficult, and sometimes, you know, you get frustrated, he gets frustrated, and for all of us it's a challenge, absolutely, but we are very keen to see the positives and to see the opportunities and to see it in a light, which means we take something from it all the time.
It's kind of teaching him that nothing should stop him from doing what he needs to do, hence why we always make sure we go, even though it is kind of, you pack the whole car and you're thinking most of this is just his equipment that he needs to sleep with, or he needs his cough machine, etc. But we still do, even if it's a night away, we still do it because we don't want him to stop doing things. And eventually when things open up, we'll start traveling again and flying abroad, because we don't want him to feel, because we've always said it's that nothing's impossible, everything is possible. It's just us having to figure out. And he sometimes goes, well, how will we do this? And I look at him and go, but do you need to worry about that? No, Mama and Dad are doing it. And then we have to just tell him what we've decided to do, because I think it just alleviates his anxieties. How are we going to do this? And when's that going to happen? So, it's making sure we stay positive so that he sees us being positive about life and that his life will be just as good as any able-bodied person.
Yeah. I don't know if you know, Pano, I wrote a book called Everything Is Possible.
Oh, did
and
you?
It's about all the travels I've done. And I sort of cite that when I was growing up, Mum and Dad did it, and I was in ignorant, sort of, yeah, ignorant bliss to it. But then there's a point, obviously, where I took on that pragmatic, logistical, practical side. But yeah, I think it sounds as quite a similar journey.
I'll have to find that.
Yeah,
yeah, we'll have to
find it.
Yeah, so everything is possible. Totally agree with you on that front. We're almost at the end of the chat, really. And I suppose specific to Spinraza, I touched upon maybe respiratory, there's been some improvement. But yeah, just any general observations in the time since he's been taking it?
I mean, what's interesting about the assessments that we have is that, and also considering that against the fact that, as we all know, it's a degenerative condition, there's a definite stabilization of what he can do, and in some areas improvement. So I feel that that's a massive step. Of course, it's not a miraculous situation. He won't take it one day and the next day jump up and do whatever, but there are improvements in his strength, in his dexterity, in his coordination. I don't know, it's really hard to say, like Hannah says, but I do feel like he's stronger with his respiratory system. And all these things, some of them can be measured by the assessments, you know, but some of them can't. Like they're almost like improvements below the lowest that they measure. So for instance, when he's, you know, doing some of the assessments, he can rip things and he can open things and he can hold things and throw things. And they might not score, but you can still see it. And he definitely couldn't do that before. And also rewinding back and seeing old videos of, you know, when he was either first diagnosed or when he first came back home, he's so much more mobile. And like my brother has said, you know, we've not really seen my brother, like all of us have been separated through COVID. You know, John says, wow, look how demonstrative he is with his hands. He's talking with his hands, he's moving them. And he didn't do that before. And of course, and that's not going to be measured, but, you know, we do see a lot of things.
And because we live with him, we don't, I guess we see strength in that. Somebody else comes and says that, like John did, that, oh, wow, he's lifting his arms up even more to try and reach. Whereas we did see the old video of him and his arms are still on the table and he's not really lifting them, and you can see him struggling. So, yeah, he definitely has got moving. And even with his legs, we lift him up and we tell him to kick them, and he does. He'll swing them around and he'll kick them backwards and forwards. And we bought him a little exercise table exercise bike, because I saw somebody on Facebook that has a daughter with SMA doing it, so I asked her. And yeah, as soon as he got it, he absolutely loved it. He was able to move the thing, and both of us were shocked, thinking, how is he doing that? Because I didn't think he'd be able to do it. We tried with his leg, he was just struggling because of the way it sits, but yes, that kind of stuff. But one of the biggest things that I was so proud of was when he first started school, he has a one-to-one, and his cutting skills, he had to use both hands to try and use a scissor. And now he can cut a full circle with just one hand. And all of that is because they put in, obviously, for his, what do you call it, EHCP?
EHCP. So
his plan that he has to have certain targets. One of them was cutting. And, he cut in straight lines, smashed that. And now they said his next target is to cut in curved lines. And he's already smashed that by cutting out a clock and even smaller circles. And I just can't believe it, because, again, at school, they're doing such amazing work, and we shared his physio plan with them. So through play, his one-to-one was trying to do that. So I'm hoping the new one-to-one he has next year is just as good. But, we have seen things, and I just, you know, fingers crossed and pray that we continue seeing more and more improvement the more he has.
Brilliant. Well, thank you both for your time and sharing the journey you've been on. And I think it's one of those, I often, when I do the kind of conference talks, not just for SMA UK, but for businesses and all that kind of stuff, that there's like the health side is the most fundamental part, you know, managing the respiratory stuff is the biggie. And then there'll be, as I'm sure you go, you know, and Adi gets older, there's kind of the independent living side and having maybe care support and that world. And then there's like the external transport and buildings and attitudes, and there's sort of different parts of life that, you know, present some challenges undoubtedly, but I think with that positive attitude and also the charity and the community to get that, people have been there and done it, there's always answers as well. So I wish you best of luck for everything in the future, and thanks for your time today.
You too. Thank you so much, Martin.
You've been listening to the Living with SMA podcast. We hope you can join us again next time. But in the meantime, please don't forget to like and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can find out more on our website at smauk.org.uk.